This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Terrorism and America's local police. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After transit attacks in London, terrorism is considered inevitable in the United States, with the burden falling on local police. That means 18,000 separate departments with little specialized training and no access to the centralized intelligence said to be key to preventing attacks. On To The Point, we'll hear about crash training programs, Israeli guidelines, and the policy of shoot to kill. Is it really possible to stop a determined suicide bomber? Will ethnic profiling antagonize moderate Muslims at the time they're most needed in the fight against Islamic extremists? On Reporter's Notebook, President Bush goes lobbying on Capitol Hill. First the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. All over America, local police are training on how to protect against suicide bombers using Israeli guidelines and adopting the policy of shoot to kill. On To The Point, will ethnic profiling lead to deadly mistakes like the one in London? Will moderate Muslims be antagonized at a time when they're needed most? On Reporter's Notebook, President Bush and Vice President Cheney headed for Capitol Hill today. We'll hear about CAFTA, free trade for Central America. First, this news update. Four men were arrested today in Birmingham, England. One reportedly is Yassin Hassan Omar, the 24-year-old Somali, shown on videotape after a bomb failed to go off last week at London's Warren Street tube station. Neil Connor reports for the Birmingham Post. Neil, Tony Blair has called this an important development, but the police have not yet, as I understand it, confirmed the identity of this suspect. How solid do you think this is?
Well, I think the police have some reservations about coming out straight away and confirming the identity of the man that was arrested today, because a lot of the problems that we had from last week when the Brazilian man was shot, there was obviously some mistaken identity there, and they don't want to be sort of rushing into any sort of announcements and making themselves not look professional in work, because they have been conducting a very thorough and professional investigation into this. So they're just a bit cautious at the moment, but I'm sure they'll announce something at some point today.
I gather that he resisted. It took a taser to subdue him.
Yeah, I mean, that's another symptom of what happened last week, I suppose, and that there's all sorts of reports coming out at the moment. So there's reports that he had a rucksack on at the moment when he was arrested, much the same as the men who were who actually caused the explosions in London on the 7th. And the reports were that the police actually subdue him, get him to take the rucksack off, and stun him with the taser gun. But we're not entirely sure of the circumstances leading up to his arrest at the moment. The police haven't released that much details. But that could have happened.
Again, the police reportedly threw the rucksack out the window. They must have been very worried. They evacuated 100 homes around the area.
Yeah, I mean, that's come quite a common occurrence, though, now. I mean, I was at another police raid only a couple of weeks. They're quite familiar these days. I was at one a couple of weeks ago, which wasn't Terrorlinks, but it was thought it was at the start, because they found a suspect device there. And they got rid of they evacuated about 100 homes there also. But there, the residents come back after about 5 hours. They must be very concerned about today's events, because the residents are still out, and it's raining all over the place in England today, as it usually is, so the residents are stuck outside. They can't get back to their houses. So the police are obviously conducting a very, very thorough search of the premises. The forensics officers are there, and all sorts of anti-terrorist and officers are there also. But, I mean, I think the raid actually was captured. I mean, the man was actually captured by police and MI5 this morning, I believe. I think he was hiding in the house at the time. But we're not too sure yet whether he's on the verge of blowing himself up. I'm sure that's something that's going to be revealed in the next few days.
Again, it's early evening in Birmingham, as we talked to Neil Connor of the Birmingham Post newspaper. What about the other three people arrested? Do they appear to have any connection with the man who's been identified as Yassin Hassan Omar?
There's very little information at the moment on these other three men who are arrested. I mean, it's only literally a couple of miles away from the address where Omar was arrested. But we have very little information at all because a lot of the media attention is focused on the Hay Mills area of Birmingham where Omar was arrested, and it hasn't really. I mean, I haven't personally been up to Ward End today to see that site, and I don't believe the police are releasing much information on that. But again, there was very much there was lots of evidence there of an armed entry. There's a door on the floor outside the premises. Lots of forensics officers combing every inch of the house there. So, and the men were arrested under the Terrorism Act. So there is obvious links between that arrest and the arrest in Hay Mills. But I couldn't confirm much more details about that because the police, as I said earlier, being very cautious before they release information.
Again, you mentioned a moment ago the mistaken killing of the Brazilian man in the subway last week. How do people that you talk to in Britain feel now about that incident and about this shoot-to-kill policy?
Well, I think as soon as it happened, a lot of people were very concerned. They thought it was another suicide attack on a tube train. As the day evolved, it emerged that it wasn't. It was probably just police tracking one of the suicide bombers. And when it emerged that it wasn't one of the suicide bombers, it was actually an innocent man, then there was obviously a great deal of concern and a few questions asked of the police at the time. We really did think Scotland Yard, the Metropolitan Police, were facing a serious crisis at that time. But after, then people started to realise that hang on a second, they are working under very, very difficult conditions. I mean, we're a free country, the same as America is a free country. These sort of things don't happen, thankfully, a lot. But in other countries across the world, they have probably happened a lot more and they don't get on the front pages. So we have to be lucky that we live in a society where this sort of thing rarely happens. But when it does, it is a massive tragedy. But also, as well, you have to look at the opinions of the minority communities in Britain, which obviously make up quite a lot of the population. They've been very divided. Some of the minority communities, especially the Muslim community, perceive this as a sort of as some sort of threat, and they're very concerned about it, that police are just going around.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that in Birmingham. Neil Connor, thanks to you for being with us with the Birmingham Post. We're going to look at these issues in the United States in just a moment with regard to local police on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. Like other agencies all over the nation, the police force in Seattle is training to deal with suicide bombers. Last week, Chief Gil Kerlikowski told 15 captains and sergeants that make up Seattle's bomb squad, "It almost seems to be a question of when in this country, not a question of if, after London." Chief Kerlikowski, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Was London a real wake-up call for you and other police officers around the country?
Well, to put it in perspective, ever since 9/11, the issue of terrorism, particularly terrorism in all of our major urban areas, has become much more front and center. So the plans and the preparation and the training for all of the different kinds of hazards, chemical, biological, radiological, et cetera, have really increased in these large areas. We've had some federal funding help, but I think London also was it brought the suicide bombing issue even more to the forefront.
How well prepared are you in Seattle to deal with this?
Well, I'd like to tell you that we're as prepared as any of the large cities, but we also, in looking at what's occurred, of course, in Israel, what's occurred at Baghdad, the information that we've gathered, the suicide bombing danger, of course, is one of those that's the most difficult to actually prevent. And so we're not only trying to train all of our officers in the prevention aspect, but also to make sure that we have the responses and the resources if, in fact, something should occur.
So you're talking about both prevention and reaction.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Israel. To what extent are Israeli soldiers coming to Seattle, and are officers in Seattle going to Israel to try to share experiences?
Well, there are a couple points on that. One is that we have not sent anyone to Israel. A number of our commanders, including myself, have heard lectures, presentations by Israeli police officials at different forums, one most recently in San Diego, in fact. And the Israeli embassy has graciously allowed Brigadier General Simon Perry, who will be out in Seattle in August, to speak to senior police officials, not only from the Seattle Police Department, but other departments. So those experiences and that knowledge is helpful. The other, of course, are the improvised explosive devices, vehicle-borne devices. And we have had probably at least 15 of our officers who over the past several years have been activated and actually served in Iraq. And so they serve as kind of real-life experience people to bring their knowledge back to us when they return from active duty.
There was recently in London this tragic situation where an innocent man was killed by mistake, partly because of a policy being referred to as shoot-to-kill, a situation where he was suspected of carrying a bomb, apparently, into the subway, and he was killed accordingly, the policy being shoot-to-kill, because if you leave a person alive, he's liable to be able to blow himself up. Is that the policy in the United States as well?
Well, the policy in the United States, and remember that all of the police forces in this country are trained with firearms and equipped with firearms, which is very different from the UK. But the policy across the country is that officers are trained to shoot and to stop the threat completely. So there has never been any type of training, and actually it's just very impractical, such as shoot to wound. The adrenaline is pumping, the ability of officers, even highly trained officers, to be totally in control and totally accurate in those situations just precludes any type of training that would be to, as you see on TV, shoot the gun out of somebody's hand. It just doesn't work.
Again, Gil Kerlikowski is the chief of the Seattle, Washington Police Department. And, Chief, we'll come back talk to you again and again on our program. I want to introduce some other guests. First, Brian Jenkins, independent security expert, founder of RAND's research program on terrorism, author of several recent publications, and one of the people who's been studying this problem the longest in the United States. Brian Jenkins, as always, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Is it possible to stop a determined suicide bomber?
It is possible, but the risks are with anything other than a shoot-to-kill policy. There's the risk that the bomber will be able to detonate their device, killing themselves and others. And so, really, to protect against greater loss of life, countries that have faced this have adopted a shoot-to-kill policy.
What about the United States? And have there been, to your knowledge, plots to attack transit systems or other places where large numbers of people will be killed that have been foiled?
Yes, there have. As a matter of fact, in 1997, there was the so-called Flatbush plot. That is where homegrown extremists were planning on carrying out bombings on New York subway systems. One of the conspirators got cold feet, went to transit police and persuaded them in barely comprehensible English that something was up. They took him seriously, and they moved in that very night, in fact it was at dawn, and discovered the conspirators with the suicide bomb ready to go. In a more recent case in New York last year, two individuals were arrested for planning to carry out bombings on New York subways, although we don't know that those were suicide bombings.
You mentioned that the one in 1997 involved a person who was barely able to speak comprehensible English. How good is intelligence in the United States, particularly in contrast to Israel, where it's reported that there has been the infiltration of all kinds of Palestinian groups by Israeli police?
Well, we have to keep in mind that Israel is dealing with organizations. The people that carry out these bombing campaigns in Israel have a fairly significant organization. It's not just individual suicide bombers. There are recruiters, trainers, bomb builders, handlers. So there's a large infrastructure, and that provides opportunities for infiltration by the intelligence services. Looking at the kind of terrorism that we have confronted here thus far, and that we see in some of the other countries, it has a much greater local content. These are one-off conspiracies as opposed to continuing enterprises, and that makes intelligence much more difficult.
Let me go back to Chief Kierlikowski in Seattle. How much of a problem for you is this issue of intelligence, of trying to find out in advance what's liable to happen? Are you able to do that?
Well, I think there are two important points. One is that right after 9/11, not only in Seattle but many other police departments, I don't think there was as much of a relationship or trust or just even knowledge between the Muslim community, the Arab American community, and policing. And right after 9/11, we had a very serious incident at we have one of the largest mosques in the Pacific Northwest, and a person was pouring gasoline on the cars outside during prayer service. He was confronted. He pulled out a gun, fired into the ground. Our officers were able to chase him down and actually arrest him. He's in prison now. And to that, right almost immediately after that, we were able to form some trust and relationships and protection for that community, because we're going to need their eyes and ears. We're not recruiting them as informants. We're not asking them to do those things. But we want them to know that they can provide information and that it's going to be held safely and securely. The other is that we have to make sure that that police forces are aware of, it's not the thing foremost in an officer's mind on what, and I use it in quotes, routine police calls, that that terrorism may be involved. And we have to probably boost that up with our officers.
Who was the man that was pouring the gasoline on the cars?
You know, he was an individual charged federally. It was right after 9/11, and he had been drinking and took this decided to take out his anger and frustration on these people in this community and in that mosque.
He was not a Muslim himself. He was somebody attacking Muslims.
Exactly. That's okay. Exactly right. And, of course, every city, including Seattle, we had threats against people, even those that weren't Muslim, Sikhs, for instance, that were operating cabs, and people that were afraid to let their kids go to school. You know, Muslim families afraid to go out shopping wearing a headdress, a veil, traditionally. And so we wanted to make sure that that these folks knew that the police departments were going to protect them.
Chief Kierlikowski in Seattle. Back to Brian Jenkins, again, our terrorism expert, founder of the RAND Research Program on this subject. Why don't you talk about 18,000 police departments in the United States, all of them now having to gear up and try to figure out how, or at least many of them, how to deal with this kind of problem. What are the risks of ethnic profiling by police in this country?
There certainly is that. There is that risk. I mean, we're not being attacked by Viking terrorists. We're being attacked by terrorists who are inspired by a particular ideology, which has appeal in a particular community. At the same time, I think ethnic profiling is not only inappropriate, but in fact, it is bad security, because there's certainly no guarantee that terrorists are going to conform to some particular racial or ethnic profile.
So how do you determine then, other than by ethnic profiling, that somebody is likely at some given moment to launch an attack of this kind?
Well, you know, I think we have to make a distinction between the intelligence component, and that's an ongoing effort. It involves the kind of community relations, community policing that the chief of the Seattle police has just been telling us about. It does involve recruiting and informants. When it comes to actually recognizing an individual in a situation where we may be confronting, possibly confronting, a suicide bomber, it is really based upon the behavior of the individual, the environment. To use the London case, which was a rare event and a regrettable event, to be sure, in that particular case, the decision was based upon the fact that the individual involved emerged from an area, a block of apartments that were under surveillance as a possible residence of those who had participated in bombings. He was dressed in a heavy jacket despite the warm temperatures in London. I was just in London myself, and it has been running in the 90s. He took a taxi to the train station. It was outside the train station, the subway station, that he was approached by the police. Despite living in London and knowing the atmosphere in London, which is a bit tense, he ran, hurdled the turnstile, and jumped into a train about to depart the station. That behavior is, again, given the environment, indicative of a suicide bomber's behavior. So even though he did not have a bomb, he certainly sent all of the signals that, under the circumstances, told the pursuing officer, this is a significant potential danger to people around.
Brian Jenkins, again, independent security expert, formerly with RAND. Earlier, Chief Kerlikowske said that at this moment in time, the Muslim community in the United States is extremely important to dealing with this issue. Ibrahim Hooper is spokesperson for the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Washington. And Mr. Hooper, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How concerned are you, as a member of the Islamic community in this country, about ethnic profiling?
Well, it's always a concern, particularly after horrible incidents like we saw in London and in Egypt and different parts of the world. You know, the kind of knee-jerk reaction is, you know, round up the usual suspects. But I think, as was mentioned earlier, religious and ethnic profiling are not very useful in terms of law enforcement, and they serve to alienate the very communities that law enforcement agencies seek cooperation from.
That may be true, but is that understood in practice by police departments around the country?
Well, that's the thing. Often we don't see a systemic use of profiling. It's very often just an individual law enforcement official's interpretation of what policy should be, and they carry out their own personal prejudices and biases. Because the upper levels of law enforcement know that these kinds of policies aren't productive and aren't useful in terms of security.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break, and then we'll continue this conversation. I want to get Chief Kerlikowske's comment on what we just heard, and we'll hear about the Los Angeles Police Department as well. On To the Point on Reporter's Notebook a bit later, President Bush goes lobbying on Capitol Hill. We'll hear about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about 18,000 local police departments around the country trying to prepare, if they can, for the possibility of terrorism, including suicide bombers on transit systems. Perhaps not all 18,000 have that threat, but certainly many of them do. We're talking right now with Ibrahim Hooper, spokesperson for the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Washington. Mr. Hooper, our other guests, Brian Jenkins in particular, talked a moment ago about the importance of community relations and about establishing informants in the Muslim community in order to try to prevent these kinds of things from taking place. At the moment, how ready is the Muslim community, do you think, to cooperate with local police?
Well, I think if any American Muslim saw anything that was remotely suspicious or could be construed as leading to a criminal act, I think they would be more than ready to report to the nearest law enforcement agency. And we've encouraged the community to do just that, since 9/11 and before. I think what we're talking about more is the kind of chill in the air between law enforcement authorities and the American Muslim community, because many people feel targeted by selective prosecution, by various policies, whether it's immigration or the Patriot Act or whatever it is out there. So it creates kind of a reluctance to, you know, to engage with law enforcement authorities.
Earlier, Chief Kerlikowski talked a bit about the help that is being provided by the Israeli police. What's your sense of the way in which the Israelis handle these matters, and what's been the impact on the Palestinian community?
Well, I you know, every time American Muslims hear that the Israelis are training American law enforcement officials, it kind of sends a chill up your spine, because we know what the Israelis do in the occupied territories. It's daily humiliation, widespread use of profiling. It's just not something we want to replicate here in the United States. It creates the impression around the world when these kinds of stories come out that, again, it's somehow America and Israel ganging up on the Muslim world, and that's not a perception we want to foster.
Ibrahim Hooper, again, with the Council on American Islamic Relations in Washington. Back to Chief Kerlikowski in Seattle. You said that you're looking forward to hearing from various Israeli police officers. What do you say to what we just heard from Ibrahim Hooper, and how do you try to counteract the impression that he expressed in the Muslim community?
Well, I agree very much with his analysis on that. But let's put a couple things into perspective. One is that the relationship here and the fact that this city has a Arab American Muslim Advisory Committee to the Chief of Police, that CARE came here and at our invitation and the request of the Department of Justice to hold a large forum just to make sure that we were all on the same page when it came to policies and understanding and procedures. Most large city local law enforcement agencies go to a great extreme to make sure that it's understood that they are not part of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. We don't want to send that chilling effect to communities, particularly communities in which there may be victims of crime that would be reluctant to report them because they feel that local police are involved in INS, that we're way too busy to do that. So we have taken extraordinary measures and steps to do outreach. I've attended Ramadan services. Our officers will be attending an annual barbecue at the mosque that is being held by the members of that mosque just next month to show their respect and support and mutual admiration for each other, and the fact that these officers protected that that mosque after 9/11. So keep all of that in mind. The other part is that that there's no place other than Israel that has had more long-term experience with the technical problems associated with suicide bombing. And then in the racial profiling issue, one important point also is that today Ahmed Rassam was sentenced here in federal court. Bomber who was going to go to was caught here in Port Angeles, was going to go to Los Angeles Airport to detonate a bomb. All of the information that that and it's public that he has talked about is that people that were in the training camps were a broad representation, European, Caucasian, North American, on and on. So it would be, I think, foolish and naive on the part of any law enforcement agency to say, well, look, we need to look for people with a darker skin color or people with Middle Eastern. That would we're talking about behaviors and technical information, and we are certainly not interested. And I've never heard the presentations from the Israelis about those other issues. It is merely what their experiences have been, how they've dealt with the particular acts, and really importantly, what how does a city and a community respond after an act such as that? How do you do all of the work needed?
Again, Gil Karlikowski, Seattle Chief of Police. Connie Rice is a civil rights attorney in Los Angeles. She's now head of a panel investigating corruption in the Los Angeles Police Department, although she has both represented the department and has sued it on behalf of various clients. She's also co-director of the Advancement Project in Los Angeles, an expert on police and community relations. And Connie Rice, always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What concerns do you have about police around the country dealing with some of the issues that we have talked about? Chief Karlikowski suggests a very sophisticated understanding of all of this up in Seattle. Is that generally the case on the part of police officers?
I think what you've heard in the program, Warren, are some very intelligent takes on the approaches and what we have to do. And so I just want to say that you've pulled together some great guests. But across the United States, when you talk about profiling and the tactics that law enforcement can do in this struggle against violent jihadi extremism, you've got to know the limitations, and I think you heard a few of them before. Profiling, intelligently done, looks at behaviors. It doesn't look at communities, and we don't want to do what the FBI did right after 9/11 when they were going through the streets of Manhattan and snatching anybody out of cabs who looked Arab. That is exactly what they did. That was a finding by the FBI's Inspector General. So smart profiling that is based on behaviors and intelligence makes sense. But what you find in too many United States police departments is you do not have police officers who are sophisticated and culturally competent to understand the communities, and they don't have the connections, they don't have the relationships that are needed. And that's how you get. A lot of LAPD, they don't even stay long enough in a division to figure out who's a real gangbanger and who isn't. So if we can't predict when the Grape Street Crips are going to do a drive-by, and that's within a culture we know and can infiltrate, you can't predict when Tim McVeigh is going to blow up the Murrah building. I think we have to understand the severe limitations on being able to get the kind of intelligence from groups that come from tribes in Waziristan with dialects you can't even learn. I just think there's severe limitations on what we're going to be able to do on the law enforcement side.
So other than throw up your hands, what do you recommend?
Well, I think that we've got this struggle flipped. I'm not saying law enforcement shouldn't do anything. You should do everything you can up to the benefit-cost analysis of how many of your freedoms do you give up to get increased security. I think you do what you can. You don't do everything you can, because if you did, you'd shut down airlines to make airlines safe. You just get rid of air travel. That's the best way. But we're not going to do that. We have to figure out what is a reasonable cost to secure at our airports and our mass transit, given the purpose of mass transit and so forth. So I'm not saying law enforcement is none of it, but war isn't going to do it. And what the real answer is I think you heard it in some of the previous discussion. This is not a war against Islam. It is a struggle against violent extremism. And it happens to come from the jihadi extremism right now, but it could come from elsewhere in the future. And therefore, it is a war of ideology. It is a war for hearts and minds. And the key to what we need to do in the United States is we need to shore up the Muslim American and the Arab American and immigrant communities, because they are the ones who can put forth an alternative ideology. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. There is currently being discussed and has been launched in the Islamic Alliance for Northern America, already a campaign to make sure that the extreme ideologies don't take root with young Muslim Americans or Muslim immigrants. The Muslim elders are saying, you know what, we need to know what's going on with our kids, and we need to do a campaign. We need to do the same thing in terms of our gang, extreme violence from our own domestic gangs. But in this arena, if we don't shore up moderate, modern Muslim Americans who can offer that alternative ideology and can define Islam in a way for the world that gets away from this madness, we will lose this war. We can invade and occupy as many countries as we want to. It's not going to solve it.
Connie Rice, civil rights attorney in Los Angeles. Back to Brian Jenkins, our terrorism expert. We've talked a lot, you and I, on this program day after day, it would seem, about the police presence, about military efforts to deal with terrorism. Is Connie Rice right that if you don't deal with it in the manner that she suggests, inevitably then you're not going to win?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that is correct. This is an ideological contest. It is not a quarrel with Islam. It is an ideological contest with a small number of people who have distilled from a religion as well as from other revolutionary ideologies a particular ideology that involves the use of terrorism as one of its components. When we look at this, we have to look at this more broadly, not just simply what we will do at the last line of defense to neutralize a suicide bomber. At that point, our options are few, and mistakes, as we've seen in London, can be made. We really have to look at what can we do to disrupt the recruitment of young men into this ideology. What can we do with regard to not only killing or capturing those who have joined these various organizations, but what can we do to even entice those who may have become disillusioned with the ideology back into society? Can we offer them a way back? And for those who are in our custody, and the chief in Seattle mentioned the sentencing of Ahmed Ressam today, what can we do with those who are in captivity to turn them around? And not simply to imprison them or detain them for lengthy periods of time, but to utilize them in furthering efforts to discourage recruiting.
All right, Brian Jenkins. Let me go back to Ibrahim Hooper, our spokesperson for the Council on American Islamic Relations in Washington. How well are we doing as a society right now at achieving the kinds of objectives that Brian Jenkins and Connie Rice have talked about?
Well, I think one problem we have is that the mainstream Muslim community is not being sufficiently engaged by policymakers. We often see the marginalization of mainstream groups by those who want to minimize any influence from Muslim communities, whether it's in this country or around the world. And that decreases our ability to marginalize extremism. I should note, we're going to hold a news conference in Washington tomorrow to release a fatwa or an Islamic religious ruling against terrorism from the FIC or Jurisprudential Council of North America.
Again, Ibrahim Hooper with CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Back to Connie Rice. How can the rest of the community engage mainstream Muslims of the sort that Ibrahim Hooper mentions?
Well, I think it's on us. I think that Muslim Americans are the one set of our communities that are really actively engaged in this struggle, other than our troops who are dying in Afghanistan and Baghdad and a few experts. But if you talk about community engagement, here in Los Angeles, the Islamic Center and other Muslim American and Muslim immigrant groups have a formal relationship with the FBI to shore up their mosques from infiltration. And it is not just simply a couple of meetings. They actually have a program to shield and fortify mosques against infiltration by extremists. And so for the rest of us, Warren, I think it's up to us to say, you know what, we need to stand with them. We need to get resources. They don't have the civic infrastructure. They don't have the data banks. They don't have the infrastructure that they need to be able to take this campaign to the larger United States, which does not see Muslim Americans much beyond the rubric of terrorism. And if we don't understand this vastly diverse set of communities and understand the different prongs of Islam and understand the struggle for modern Islam, we can't help them. And what the rest of us Americans have been told to do is fly our flags and go shopping, but I think we've got an obligation to say, wait a minute, we can't leave this to law enforcement. We cannot leave this to the military. That can't work. It isn't working. In fact, it's probably creating more blowback than anything. We've got to get smart about this, and the smartest way is to stand with the Muslim American community and other, and the Arab American community and other communities that are directly on the front lines in this ideological war. And we can do it by helping them put on forums, helping them launch a campaign, helping to educate other Americans about what this struggle really is about.
Ibrahim Hooper, back to you. What about some of the issues that Islam, that the Muslims in the United States are concerned about, such as, for example, Israeli-Palestinian relations and the war in Iraq? Do they have to be addressed in a different way?
Well, if we wanted to do one thing as a nation that would help win the war on terrorism, we would forcefully and in a very strong way provide justice to the Palestinian people. That is the one issue that goes across every other issue that we see in the war on terrorism. But for 50-some years, we've sided with one party in the conflict and given unflinching support to one party at the expense of the other. And if we really are serious about fighting the war on terrorism, provide justice to the Palestinian people.
Brian Jenkins, back to you. What about that point and the contention on the part of many Muslims in the United States that this country is allied with Israel in some way against people of their faith?
The country is allied with Israel. I don't think it's allied with Israel against people of the Muslim faith. I mean, keep in mind, for many, many years, this was not a struggle which involved, even in Israel and Middle East, which involved Islam. It was a secular struggle. The Palestinian organizations were secular organizations. Clearly, the United States pays a price for its alliance with Israel. Having said that, I'm not entirely persuaded that were we to alter that policy, and that has to be addressed on its own merits, I think, but were we to alter that policy, would that stop the jihadists who have a long list of disputes, as they see, a long list of grievances, with the United States? And the answer I come to is, I think those who have joined the jihadist enterprise are determined to come after the United States. They can use these various issues as recruiting themes. They do have some attractiveness, but they are determined, and they will not be dissuaded by changes in U.S. policy.
Now, Ibrahim Hooper, we're effectively out of time, but very quickly, you said that one thing, the most important thing that could be done is to see that there's justice for the Palestinians. Would you dispute, though, that there are these other complex issues as well that Brian Jenkins has referred to?
You know, terrorism isn't going to go away if you have justice for the Palestinian people, but it removes the major issue that is exploited by extremists to recruit more terrorists.
All right. We have no more time. I'm sorry for that, but that's the way it goes in radio. Thank you all for being with us. Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Brian Jenkins, formerly with RAND, independent security expert, Connie Rice, civil rights attorney in Los Angeles, and our first guest, Chief Gil Kerlikowski, with the Chief of Police in Seattle. When they want something badly, presidents usually invite senators and Congress members down to the White House. Today, President Bush and Vice President Cheney headed for Capitol Hill. They were pushing for CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. We'll hear what's at stake there in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Alney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. CAFTA would establish free trade with Central American countries, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic. It has passed the Senate, but despite heavy lobbying by President Bush, success in the Congress is not guaranteed. Paul Bluestein is economics writer for The Washington Post. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Opponents of CAFTA are saying that the president, the vice president, when they go down to Capitol Hill, are trying to make deals to buy votes. Who do they have to deal with?
Well, there's a group of about two dozen, maybe three dozen Republicans that, for various reasons, are either extremely just refusing to vote for CAFTA or very loath to do it. There's some that are out and out refusing. They've made their positions very clear. They don't like it for a lot of some of the same reasons that Democrats, you know, don't like free trade agreements. They're concerned about low wage competition destroying jobs in their communities. There are others who for various special interest reasons, for example, people from districts where sugar beets are grown or textile factories are prevalent. They're very concerned about the impact of competition from Central America there. And some are just just really feeling the political heat about free trade in general, and would prefer to be to vote against it, and are having to be induced by various things like we don't know exactly what these things are yet, but we know that there's a big highway bill that's supposed to pass Congress in a day or two, and members have told us that there are various goodies that will be tucked into that bill for Republicans who go along with the House leadership in the White House.
So there's a lot of log rolling going on.
Oh, yeah. I'm shocked to hear that it's going on in this casino.
What about CAFTA? What exactly would it provide? How is it different from NAFTA?
Well, it's not very different from NAFTA. There are some there are all kinds of, small detailed ways in which it's different, but fundamentally it's the same principle. You're knocking down barriers to trade between the United States, in this case, but five Central American countries plus the Dominican Republic. In the case of NAFTA, you're talking about Mexico, and before that, Canada. But it's basically the same principle, and the objections to it that are being raised are rather similar. Except, these five Central American countries are a smaller economy than Mexico. You don't hear the talk about the giant sucking sound of jobs going south, but. But the basic principle of this free trade agreement is the same.
What are the arguments being made for it on behalf by the president and the vice president?
Well, today they were apparently focusing a lot on the national security concern. These are countries that could go back to the bad old ways in Latin America of being anti-American and. Supporting the sort of the Bolivarian movement that's springing up now in Venezuela, with that's kind of friendly with Fidel Castro and all that, that has some sway with members. But the broader point that they've been making all along, the overwhelming majority of independent economists also make, is that free trade is a mutually it's a win-win deal. It's beneficial for both sides. And although this agreement economically has is very insignificant. You're talking about the U.S. economy, an $11 trillion economy, and these economies being less than a percent of that in terms of GDP. The idea is that if you by building free trade agreements one country at a time, you eventually build toward a great big global agreement in the World Trade Organization, and that this is the way to do it. That's the argument for it. And that if you don't pass CAFTA, that you'll never get that big, much bigger, more important trade deal.
Tom DeLay said today that he thinks it's going to be very tough, but that they will pass CAFTA tonight. He's a pretty good vote counter, one would assume, but it sounds as if it's anything but guaranteed.
I'm not a congressional reporter. I'm a trade reporter, but my understanding of Tom DeLay is that he does not make statements like that unless he can back them up. He did say we will pass CAFTA tonight. He did say it would be a tough vote, but I think what he means by that is that he's going to have to tell some Republican members who are very loath to vote for this bill that he needs their vote, and that he's going to have to, and that he's going to give them stuff that maybe even then. They would still prefer to vote against it, but he's going to have to say to them, I'm sorry, but we really need you on this. And they know that his wrath, about the hell hath no fury. Well, I think in the case of Tom DeLay, it way surpasses the woman scorned.
So you got goodies on the one hand, and you got the wrath of Tom DeLay, whatever form that might take. On the other, why, when these six small countries have a combined economic output, smaller than the state of Connecticut, why is this so important to the president?
It's not that the agreement itself is so important. It's certainly not important to the U.S. economy at all. It's a blip economically to the U.S. economy. But if it does fail, it would be a huge setback to the whole trade agenda that the president has, which is he's aiming for some much bigger fish. I mean, one of the bigger fish is the free trade area of the Americas, which would extend NAFTA basically all the way to all of South America, and the big catch there would be the Brazilian market. But even that is really small potatoes compared to what they're really hoping to get here, which is an agreement in the World Trade Organization by sometime next year which would lower barriers in among the 148 countries of the World Trade Organization, and that is something that most economists would agree, you know, would have a substantial impact on the global economy. And if momentum for that momentum for that would be, I would say, not necessarily fatally staggered, but badly staggered. If the U.S. were unable to get Congress to go along with a free trade agreement with six small Central American countries, some people don't think that's a good thing if momentum is staggered. But I'm just saying that's what the stakes are.
What about the other 148 countries? How eager are they to engage in this kind of an arrangement?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question because in fact, momentum toward that agreement has already been severely slowed. Just among looking at the negotiations and how they're proceeding in Geneva, where the World Trade Organization is headquartered, progress toward a deal recently has absolutely come to a stall. Now, these things have ways of they tend to go in cycles, you know, where the members, just aren't able to come to agreement, and they stare each other down, and they say, well, I guess that's it. I'm walking away from the table. And then finally, they come back together because they realize the thing's falling apart. But at the moment, a failure of CAFTA, I would say, would set it way back in the deep end.
All right. A lot at stake. Paul Bluestein with The Washington Post, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum, Jonah King, Carmen Radziner, Technical Director John Patrick Costello. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.